Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna. Välkommen tillbaka till Hästveterinärerna, podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med hästar. Jag heter Maria Willemsson och i det tredje och sista avsnittet med Andy Durham om PPID så berättar Andy mer om sambandet mellan PPID och insulindysreglering. Hur det går tillväga rent praktiskt för att testa för insulindysreglering och varför det är en god idé att testa PPID-hästar för insulindysreglering mer rutinmässigt.
So we're going to be talking about PPID and insulin dysregulation in this episode. And the first and maybe the most important question that I'm going to ask is, how important is the test for insulin dysregulation in PPID patients? Do you test every horse?
Yeah, I think that this is one of the biggest issues for me in terms of, you know, diagnostics and monitoring in PPID, because it's so frequently overlooked, and it is so important, important. You know, ACTH, for example, is a great test to decide if the horse has got PPID, but it doesn't tell you much, if anything, about the risk of laminitis in that PPID case. And as we know, some PPID cases get laminitis and some don't. So testing ACTH, yep, tells you it's got PPID, but really in order to decide whether it's likely to get laminitis or not, you need to assess its insulin status, not its ACTH. So, yeah, in my view, if you feel a horse deserves testing for PPID, it absolutely deserves testing for insulin dysregulation as well.
Because I think it's quite common that vets will test for PPID if they have the clinical suspicion and if the horse also has symptoms of EMS like fat pads or something like that, then they will also test for insulin dysregulation, but not necessarily in every case. But you're saying it should be done in every case that you test for PPID, you should also test.
Yeah, absolutely should. You know, I mean, you clearly do see those kind of combination cases, and that's absolutely correct. You know, they deserve testing for, you know, I suppose you've got one mind on EMS and test the insulin, and you've got the other part of your mind on PPID and you're testing for ACTH. But even if 100% of your mind is just on PPID, you know, if you've got a 28-year-old, you know, lean thoroughbred or something that you think has got PPID, you should absolutely test its insulin status as well, because you know, it's not just the combination cases that have problems with insulin. The pure 100% PPID only cases will sometimes have a problem with insulin as well.
Yeah, and we talked about it, because the reason why many vets do not take the insulin tests are, I suppose, because they feel that it's a little bit more tricky and how to handle the samples and so on. But if they were to take both samples, how would they practically do it? Does it require a whole lot of preparation, or can they just come to the barn and do both tests, or what do you think?
Yeah, well, they can. I mean, we went into it a little bit more detail in one of the webinars. But, you know, essentially, you got three choices, although one of them I cross off immediately. I think a fasting insulin, you know, taking an insulin after a period of fasting, I don't think has any value whatever, really, in simple terms. So a fasting insulin, just no, that's no value in that. So you got two choices, really. You either just take the insulin when the horse has just been doing what it does and eating what it eats, and you just happen to be there and you get an insulin. Or the other option is you set up some kind of oral sugar test, you know, whether that's Danzucker, if I pronounce that correctly, or whether it's glucose dextrose, whether it's carolite syrup, but you do a post-sugar test. And I think in order to answer the question, is this horse insulin dysregulated or not, which is the question you are asking, then you would rather have a post-sugar test But obviously that requires setting up to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. You've got to set up the dosing of the horse and the timing of your visit and all that kind of thing, which obviously can be a disincentive. It may well be that when you arrive to take the ACTH, you know, either you didn't think that through or the owner didn't, and you're just there anyway. So I think under those circumstances, just taking a sort of random insulin when you happen to be there is fine. But what I would always want to know from the owner, and you just ask them, is what has the horse been eating over the last few hours? Because, you know, obviously insulin changes a lot through the day, you know, from zero to potentially hundreds through the course of a day, depending on what the horse has eaten and when it ate it. You know, nothing has changed physiologically just because you've got PPID or EMS. A horse still only secretes insulin in response to eating. There is no other reason we know of why a horse would secrete insulin. And the amount of insulin it secretes depends on what exactly it's eaten. So you need to know that. So if the horse has just eaten something really bland, you know, like some poor hay or straw or whatever, then you absolutely would expect a low insulin. And if it's just been grazing, you would expect the insulin to be a bit higher. So, you know, you've got to interpret that insulin in the light of what the horse has just eaten. But I think that is acceptable. You know, if you're just there, you know, you just happen to be there at 1 o'clock on a Thursday to take an ACTH, and then you think, oh, actually, it'd be good to see what the insulin status is too, then I think it is acceptable just to take a blood for insulin as well, asking the owner what the horse has just eaten. But in a perfect world, which we don't live in, but in a perfect world, if you've thought about it before and the owner was willing, it would be nice to set up some kind of oral sugar test.
Yeah. So it's often that could be a problem. So if the vet comes to the barn and the horse is set up for a vaccination, just like a normal vaccination, it comes in from grass, it's supposed to be vaccinated, and you have the conversation just before you're vaccinated about this whole problem, the owner will say, well, why don't we take the test right away? Then it could be possible, as long as you know the history, how long has it been grazing for, etc.
Yeah, it absolutely could. I think the one thing you've got to be careful of, though, is being too reassured by a low insulin. You know, because if the horse, that would be an ideal circumstance that you just described then. Because if the horse has literally just come in from grazing, you would expect his insulin to probably be the highest of the day then. So if it's low, then you're all good then. And you say, well, if it's a low insulin post grazing, then there's not much realistic chance that horse is insulin dysregulated. But on the other hand, if it's a low insulin when the horse has been standing in its stable for the last hour with nothing to eat and or perhaps some scrubby old hay or something, then, you know, it might be still insulin dysregulated. It's just that it hasn't been given enough sugar to show that, I suppose. So you've got to interpret it in the light of what it's just been eating, but nevertheless, it's still a useful sample.
And now, just to clarify, when you say low versus high, what does that mean in numbers?
Yeah, well, it's an important question, but I suppose we don't really know, I suppose. I mean, it's very clear that insulin's over 200. There's a couple of different studies really showing insulin's over 200 are pretty likely to be damaging the laminae. So I think if you're seeing those kind of numbers, that can't be good. And what we don't really know is, you know, what is okay and what isn't. Because it's okay saying an insulin over 200 would damage the laminae, but maybe an insulin of 100 would if it was present for twice as long or something. You know, we haven't got that finesse in terms of the interpretation. And we do need more information on that. So, you know, and this is just a gut feel, you know, I don't really have any evidence for this at all, but just from dealing with these cases, if it was my horse or my pony, I wouldn't really want to see that insulin, well, definitely not going above 100 at any point during the day. And I'd rather it was closer to 50, really, at, you know, as the peak insulin through the day. So if you were to test that horse or pony at its worst time during the day, which, you know, could be post-grazing, could be post-hay, actually, you know, plenty of hay has high sugar. But if it's its worst time during the day, I would really like it to be no more than 50 or 60. And I think if it's going much higher than that, over 100, definitely over 200, you're going to be getting damage to the laminae. And I'd prefer to use that term specifically, actually, when talking to owners. I'd prefer to use that term damage to the laminae rather than laminitis, because, you know, if you've taken a post-grazing insulin that's 300, say, and you say to the owner, well, that's going to cause laminitis, the owner would be saying, well, it's obviously not causing laminitis because the horse is sound at the moment, you know, so they kind of don't believe you. But if you say damage to the laminae, you know, it's perfectly possible. And, you know, there's very good evidence that the laminae can be kind of subtly damaged for quite a long time before you see any clinical evidence of pain. So you know, it's easier to convince people that those high insulins are subtly causing damage to the laminae, even when it's not clinically evident.
Yeah. So at that point in time, you will do, of course, the ACTH testing as well as the insulin test, and then combine those two results to kind of gauge what the risk of laminitis is, whether the horse should be started on Percolide, depending on the clinical signs, et cetera, and then make up a plan for that particular horse.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's really important to take that insulin into account. And if the basal insulin that you just happen to measure at the time, you know, comes back quite low, you get an element of reassurance from that, but you'd still rather follow that up with an oral sugar test if you can. But obviously that will just depend on whether the owner will have you back or not. But that would be advice to follow it up with an oral sugar test. But if it's already high, then you know you've got a problem anyway. If that insulin is high already, then you'd know you've got an insulin dysregulated case. So high values are definitely worrying. Low values ideally should be followed up with an oral sugar test, unless it happened to be a post-grazing test, which essentially is an oral sugar test, I suppose.
I guess this is a random question out of the blue, but do we know how many of the PPID horses do have hyperinsulinemia at the same time? Do we have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, there's different evidence from different sources. One sort of unpublished study, I think I put in one of the webinars earlier on from our hospital lab, looked at a load of PPID cases. And we actually found 90% of them pretty much had a history of laminitis and hyperinsulinemia. But then, you know, it's a very biased population coming into a lab, because I think it's the PPID cases with laminitis that are more likely to be tested. So I really don't believe it's actually that high. I think it was Han van der Kolk at Utrecht, when he was at Utrecht, at least anyway, and I think Clint Hammer might have been another one of the authors, did a study a while back, probably 10, 20 years ago, actually looking at tests of insulin resistance. I think they were clamping or something. And I'm pretty sure they suggested a prevalence of about a third, something like that, about a third of PPID cases. So I think that is probably more realistic. You know, I think that kind of percentage, I think, rather than a 90% that we showed.
But it still, that emphasizes that maybe one third of them are prone to get more severe laminitis than the rest of them.
Oh, a significant number, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, I suppose the other element of that, which we don't necessarily know, is, you know, is it simply a question of some PPID cases get it and some don't? Or is it a stage of progression of the disease even? So even if they don't, and we just don't know that, I suppose. So even if they don't have insulin dysregulation when you see them, that doesn't mean to say they won't in time, I suppose. So it's something to always keep in mind.
If we go back to the oral sugar test, you said it wasn't maybe ideal to do those both tests at the same time, the ACTH and the oral sugar test. How come?
Yeah, well, sorry, I'm really talking mainly about practicality there, really, because it just needs setting up a little bit in advance. And I suppose the way I look at it is we're starting from a point right now where, you know, most vets and owners, well, this is certainly my very strong experience in the UK anyway, most vets and owners, when they're seeing a PPID case, are only choosing to test ACTH.
Yeah.
I would love to get to a stage where every one of them is doing an ACTH and an oral sugar test.
Yeah. Okay.
But that does require a little bit of setting up.
Yeah.
So I think possibly in an interim period, just getting a basal insulin I would settle for, because at least that's a step forward anyway.
Yeah. Good. It's good to clarify, because I think the ACTH won't be affected by the oral sugar test or the glucose syrup or anything like that.
No, a TRH stim test can, but that obviously, you know, is not such a popular test, and I think particularly in the Nordics anyway.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a few studies looking at potential effects of feeding on ACTH, whether that's oral sugar or other feeds, and there's been, you know, slightly conflicting findings, but there's no good evidence that, you know, giving a horse a dose of sugar is really going to markedly affect its ACTH value. I think you can still trust that.
Yeah. That's good to know. So yeah, so then if a vet then goes out to see a patient and the reason why he or she does that is because the owner suspects PPID, then also prepare to take an insulin test, whether it's then the oral sugar test or just a basal insulin.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, whether or not you also suspect EMS, that's irrelevant. You know, just the fact that you're going to investigate PPID means that horse deserves its insulin status assessing as well.
Yeah, very interesting and very good point as well. So we have been talking, at least we at Boehringer have been talking a lot about the ACTH test, how to do it practically with the EDTA tube and the centrifuge, and you also did that in your lecture, just as a reminder. But what about the insulin test?
Yeah, insulin is probably not quite so difficult in that, you know, one of the fundamental worries with ACTH is it's a slightly unstable molecule, so you've got to handle it a little bit carefully. I mean, you know, every biochemical test we do is unstable to a degree. You know, you can't really test much in a sample that's 2 weeks old or something. But insulin's reasonably stable. You don't necessarily need to do much preparation. I think most laboratories, and you just have to check whichever laboratory you use, but I think most would be testing either on separated serum or heparinized plasma. And ideally, that would be separated before it's posted, you know, again, preferably in a centrifuge. You know, I think it's never ideal to be sending whole blood for these kind of tests because you can get hemolysis in the post and that kind of thing. So depending on what your lab want, you know, separated serum or separated heparinized plasma is probably what you need. And if you're sending an ACTH anyway, then it might as well go in the same chilled packaging. But for testing insulin alone, there's no particular requirement for chilling. You know, as long as it gets to the lab within sort of 24, 48 hours, it should be fine.
So it sounds almost easier than the ACTH.
Yeah, it's not so much to worry about in terms of sample handling.
So coming back to the patient that you came to the barn to do a dental on, and you come to talk to the owner, and during this talk, you talk about some clinical signs that the horse might have PPID as well. But you sedated the horse and you already did the dental. So in that situation, how would the blood process or blood draw go there? Is that something that the vet can still do, or
no? That would be a problem. That would be a big problem, really. I think sedation's a problem in two ways, really. I mean, one is, well, assuming you've used some kind of alpha 2 anyway, which I think most of us probably would. Alpha 2s cause a hyperglycemia fairly promptly, and that hyperglycemia will then increase insulin fairly promptly. So again, if it's more than a couple of minutes, you know, since you've given the sedation, then you definitely can't be trusting an insulin value. Now, there's less known about the effects on ACTH, actually. There is one study, and sorry, the author's name escapes me now, but they did look at ACTH, I think, within about 10 minutes of sedation and didn't find any changes. But, you know, if you've already done your dental and this, that, and the other, there is, strictly speaking, no evidence around that. But on countless occasions, I have seen in our lab surprisingly high ACTH values in horses that were sedated, and then the vet has taken one a few days later unsedated and got a far lower value. So I'm 100% convinced that that any sort of delay after sedation, like having done a dental or whatever, will completely mess up your ACTH, so you can't really trust it then either. So no, I think if the big dilemma that does crop up is when you've got a real needle shy horse, and you know, this is a conversation I have with quite a few vets, really, and they'll say, well, look, I can just about get some intramuscular detomidine into it, but that's all. And I think that's a problem then. I don't think, you know, because by the time the intramuscular has worked, I suspect both the ACTH and the insulin will be affected. If you did IV with detomidine or xylazine or rimifidine and then took a blood fairly quickly afterwards, you'd probably be okay. But then, you know, if you could IV it, then you could have taken the blood beforehand, I suppose. So that's not much help, really. So no, I think sedation does mess it up if there's a delay between sedation and sampling.
So there are enough kind of worries about test results sometimes in the mix, that you don't need to add another worry about whether your test results come back as valid.
Yeah, and it's a big effect as well. You know, it's not just a subtle difference. Yeah. I think ACTH and insulin can be markedly affected by sedation. So there's just no point in doing it.
So you need to talk the owner into rescheduling to another time and then explain to them how to set up the oral sugar testing and everything, so you get two good test sample of ACTH and insulin.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I just wouldn't be tempted to do it at all after the sedation and everything, because you will get an uninterpretable result. It's not something that's going to make a little bit of difference. It'll make a big difference. There's no point in doing it.
That sounds fair.
So moving on then to other issues when it comes to insulin dysregulation or PPID as well. Of course, management, of course, is a big part in these horses. What do we have to say there? I mean, we have been talking a lot previously about the sugar content of the feed and losing weight and everything like that. What's your take on this? And also considering the differences between PPID horses with insulin dysregulation and PPID horses without insulin dysregulation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, those two groups, with and without insulin dysregulation, you know, would require very different management. And I suppose the other thing to throw into that as well is their body condition good or poor too? Yeah. Because, you know, essentially, a PPID case with no insulin dysregulation and good body condition doesn't require any particular dietary management. That's fine. You just treat it as a normal horse. Mm. If they're insulin dysregulated, then, you know, you have to manage their insulin responses. You have to make sure their insulin responses are not high, and they will be, obviously, by definition, more prone to hyperinsulinemia. So restricting sugar intake is really important. Although we've offered guidance in the past, I really don't think it's a valid way of dealing with these cases. In other words, what I'm saying is, I don't think there's a sugar content of the ration that you say is okay or not okay.
Yeah.
The thing that is or isn't okay is what their insulin response is.
Yeah, so I noticed also that you say we have to manage their insulin and not manage necessarily the
dietary sugar. Well, that's right, because I think the same dietary sugar content two different horses will respond differently to.
Yeah.
But it's not the dietary sugar that causes laminitis. It's their insulin response to it.
Yeah.
And so that's the only thing you can judge them on. Those horses that secrete a lot of insulin, whether that's to a high or low dietary sugar, will get laminitis.
Yeah.
And those that don't won't. You know. So it's the insulin responses we should focus on. And you know, there's some good evidence we discussed earlier on that's come out of Uppsala in terms of the weakness in designing your dietary management around the sugar content of forage, because even the low sugar forages can provoke very high insulin concentration sometimes. And, you know, and that's the point. It's the high insulin concentrations. It doesn't matter what the sugar content of the forage is. It doesn't matter if it's 5%, 10% or 50%. What matters is what the insulin response to it is.
Yeah.
And that's, to be honest, an easier thing to measure anyway. You know, it's there's all sorts of issues involved with assessing the sugar content of a ration. You know, sampling error not being the least of. You know, you have a bale of hay, and you would only take a small part of that to measure the sugar content, let alone the whole stack of hay.
Yeah.
So is it very representative anyway, even if you measure it? But what you need to know is what the insulin response is, because that's what causes laminitis.
Would you be so, how do you say, as a vet then, courageous to ask the owner to don't spend your money on a feed analysis, spend your money on an insulin test?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely, 100%. You could argue there are other values in a feed analysis in terms of checking what the protein level and all that kind of thing is. But I personally feel the sugar content.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing. You know, there are lots of different ways of feed companies assessing the sugar content.
Yeah.
And some of the methods are more valid than others as well. So you might be paying for a test that isn't a particularly good one anyway. Mm. But anyway, even if we trust the results of the sugar analysis that comes back, it still is meaningless. you know, what you need to know is what the horse's insulin response is to that. And, you know, it's not the sugar content that causes laminitis. It's their insulin response to it. And, and that can be very different in different individuals.
Interesting. Yeah. I think we have to rethink the feeding advice around it. Maybe not completely, because it's still valid. I mean, and I guess it's always the less sugar, the better.
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, intuitively, you're right. You can't help but think, oh, yeah, but all the same, if the sugar content's 7%, I'd still rather give that than a sugar content of 20.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, Ellen Svonny's work would suggest not really. You know, the 7% could still be causing a problem. So why bother? You know, because I don't know about relative costs of these things in the Nordic countries, but I suspect probably the hay analysis is more expensive than checking the insulin anyway. And you know, the sampling error, I think, is a really big consideration too. You know, if you grab that handful of hay, it might be 7%. If you grab that handful from a different part, it might be 15%, you know, because when you look at a field, you know, that's going to be cut for hay, it's not like every single part of the field looks the same. You know, there'll be bits of quite lush green grass, and there'll be bits of poor grass, and you know, so it stands to reason that that the hay that you get won't be all the same. It's not all you know, homogenous. It's going to be quite different, I think.
I have a question about like, if insulin dysregulation is like a static thing, because if we have a PPID horse and we test it with an oral sugar test as well, and it's abnormal, it's hyperinsulinemic, high risk of laminitis, the owner is doing all they can with medical treatment, with management, and etc. Are there any cases where if you repeated the oral sugar testing that it would turn into a normal value, or will it always be considered being abnormal?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think I think the answer is it's different for different cases. I think it is possible to normalize an oral sugar test result, especially on medication. You know, I think particularly if you're using, for example, SGLT2 inhibitors, absolutely. You know, I think it's not just possible, it's probably expected actually to normalize the response while they're on treatment. You know, that is a really important thing with SGLT2 inhibitors. If anyone's using those, you know, they don't cure anything. They kind of, you know, they only work by increasing glucose output from the horse, glucose loss, and therefore keeps insulin low. So it only works while they're on the treatment. You know, it's not like an antibiotic treating an infection and making it better. It doesn't change the metabolic status. It just more masks the metabolic status, I suppose. But absolutely, you can then. I mean, as regards dietary management alone without drugs, then yeah, I think changing the diet over time, you know, especially if it's associated with body condition loss and that kind of thing, will sometimes alter the oral sugar test response, but often it doesn't.
Yeah, because my point was that means that if you've done one oral sugar test and the horse is abnormal, hyperinsulinemic, then it doesn't seem like there's much value into repeating that as a test. Then you should go into a meal test to see how the horse responds to the particular food it's on during the year. So then you should repeat the insulin measurements on using the meal test instead of actually testing as an oral glucose test, because that would be expected to be abnormal.
Yeah, I'd agree, really, because I think that, again, is important to focus on what do the tests mean. So an oral sugar test simply tells you this individual is insulin dysregulated. Right, so you've answered that question now, so you don't need to come back to that one. That's done.
Yeah.
Now what you want to know is, does the current diet pose a risk to this horse? And that's where the postprandial testing is really important. And you can just carry on doing that. You don't need to return to the other question. You already know it's insulin dysregulated. So it doesn't matter if it stays insulin dysregulated for the rest of its life. That's fine, as long as you give it a diet that doesn't provoke a dangerous level of insulin. And, you know, as we said earlier on, where that dangerous level is might be open to debate still, but nevertheless, the lower the better. And you can just continue to, you know, you're looking basically at the appropriateness of the diet for this individual then, and you can just make amendments to the diet or possibly use SGLT2 inhibitors if needs be.
Interesting. considering then that the EMS horse is if we look away from only the sugar content or the sugar intake, we also have an aspect of calories, right? So the EMS horse is often overweight or have accumulative fat that you want to get rid of. But in the PPID horse, it's usually the other way around, or if not normal weight, then maybe underweight. How to sort of tackle those horses?
Yeah, so I think with a PPID horse that's lean, then again, the insulin status is really important, in that if they don't have a problem with their insulin regulation, yeah, I mean, arguably you're freer to kind of almost do what you like, really. But I think the ones that do require careful thought are the lean PPID cases with insulin dysregulation, because yeah, as you say, that's almost, well, not the opposite, but it's very different from dealing with an EMS case, because now we're trying to limit insulin responses and trying to increase calories, yeah, rather than decrease calories. Yeah. So that's more of a challenge, I suppose. But I do think, you know, where we're fortunate in this day and age is having a greater variety of suitable feeds. And I think one thing I think you should never underestimate is a horse's ability to extract calories from fiber, which won't affect their insulin, mm, right? Okay, it's sugars and starches that affect insulin. Mm. So what you're really aiming for is high quality fiber, which is very calorific. Horses can get a lot of calories from high quality fiber, but nothing really in terms of an insulin response. Yeah. So I guess the classic feed types in that respect, and you know, forgive me, I'm not entirely sure what's available in the Nordics, but I'm sure sugar beet pulp is. Make sure it's not molassed, obviously. Sugar beet pulp has the sugar so well extracted for the human food industry. There's very usually less than 5% sugar in it, so it's very low sugar, but the quality of the fiber is so high. You know, most non-molassed beet pulp will have a calorific value similar to kind of competition cubes, really. Yeah. It's good calories in there, and but no insulin effect, so that's great. One other feed that's relatively popular in the UK is coconut meal. Again, I don't know if it's available over here, but there's a company called Cool Stance, and Cool Stance Copra is their product. It's a coconut meal based product, which again, very high quality fiber, loads and loads of calories, but not much in the way of an insulin response from that. Rice bran type things are always worth thinking about as well. I think there's a few products like Omega Rice or Equijoule and things like that in the UK, at least, anyway, but rice bran based products. Sometimes you've got to be slightly careful with those, in that they have a very high oil content, which is great, but they can look quite starchy in terms of their analysis, but often don't seem to provoke the same kind of insulin responses.
Oh, really?
But that's, again, something to try, isn't it? You know, as I've been saying a few times, really, the proof really is, what is the insulin response to the diet? So try it out. And just oil itself, you know, oil and fat itself, you know, will obviously put condition on horses without affecting insulin at all. There was some great work from Simon Bailey, actually, in Melbourne several years ago, where he made some, I think it was Andalusian horses, actually pretty fat on high-fat diets.
Yeah.
But their insulin status didn't change at all.
Yeah.
Whereas those Andalusian horses that were made fat by giving them starch became very insulin dysregulated. Yeah. So oil feeding and fat feeding, you know, very important. So there are feeds, you know, as we said, like rice bran or whatever, that has a lot of oil in anyway, or just plain old vegetable oil or margarine or whatever. The only issue generally around fat is palatability.
Yeah.
But usually if you're giving big bulky foragey feeds, you know, lots of beet pulp and that kind of thing, you can hide quite a lot of oil in that.
Yeah.
And you might need to try a few different types of oil to see what's palatable or not. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to buy expensive kind of soya and linseed and something. It's just the cheapest stuff you can find in the supermarket, almost, that the horse will eat. A lot of people suggest you've got to make sure you're giving more antioxidant, more vitamin E alongside that, which probably isn't bad advice, you know, at least a unit per kilo every day of vitamin E. But pumping oil in. And if palatability is an issue, margarine can be good sometimes too. Some horses will eat margarine when they won't eat oil, but maybe a bit more expensive. Those are the kind of things, high calorie feeds that are based on oil and high quality fiber. You can get all those calories in without messing their insulin up.
Something that I learned with all these thousands or at least hundreds of different sorts of feeds that are out there is that just because it says like senior or lamy preventative blah 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 on the bag doesn't mean that the sugar or starch content is satisfying.
I couldn't agree more, really. I mean, I there's a presentation I've given a few times actually almost based on that, really, where you just look at the headlines on the bag and then look to see the nutrition analysis. And it's horrifying sometimes how different they are.
Yeah.
And I just think there's no way a horse of mine would ever be getting that, even though it says it's great for this, that, and the other. So, yeah, absolutely look at the nutritional analysis. And you know, as we've said a few times, if possible, just have a look to see what the horse's insulin response is to that feed, because that's what's going to be the most important thing, really.
And on that note, how would you do it practically? So you have this feed, let's say some kind of feed that claims this and this, low starch, all those things, and you want to assess that horse's insulin response to that. How do you practically do it?
Well, that's the feed assessment is probably easier than, you know, assessing forage response or grazing and that kind of thing. Because, you know, I think most animals, when they eat a meal, you know, their insulin probably peaks an hour and a half, 2 hours later, and horses are no different in that respect. You know, the horses aren't designed to eat meals, obviously, and a big net full of hay obviously isn't a meal. They eat it over a long period of time, so that becomes difficult. But if it is a meal and they are going to eat it relatively quickly, then I would just simply do that. I'd just put that in front of them, get them to eat it hopefully in less than 10 or 15 minutes, and then aim to pull an insulin about an hour and a half to 2 hours later. And that should approximate to as high as the insulin gets. You know, we still have issues in terms of how high is acceptable, but you know, if it's only going up to no more than 50 or 60, then that's probably okay.
Okay. And do they need to be fasted beforehand, or should it be as natural as possible to be able to assess it correctly?
Yeah, they don't really need fasting. I mean, you know, obviously you've got to make sure they don't have anything that's even more glycemic sort of prior to that or whatever. So, you know, but if they're just eating their hay, you wouldn't want to bring them in from grass and then do that. But if they've just been munching their hay, which you know to be okay already from some previous testing maybe, then that's fine. But yeah, I mean, I suppose you're right. I suppose it wouldn't necessarily be anything wrong in starving them for 3 hours before it or whatever, but I think as long as they've been eating their hay, which you know is okay, then you could just give them that meal, then that'd be fine.
Cool.
I think the protocol from the Uppsala study, Elin Svonis's work, was fasting during the night, so like a oral sugar test, and then I think she gave it 1.4 kilos of hay, dry matter hay per 100 kilos of body weight or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I think that was the amount. But I think the one thing you got to watch is that fasting itself will cause insulin dysregulation in horses. I mean, probably a 3 hour fast, 6 hour fast, you probably won't have anything significant. But if it's going beyond 6 hours, then just the fasting will cause insulin dysregulation and might affect your results. But a very short fast would probably be okay. And I suppose, as you say, like with Ellen, you know, most horses, I suppose, kind of self-fast a little bit overnight, don't they? Because they'll probably finish their hay in the early hours in the morning or whatever, and then they have very little for a few hours, and then you do the test in the morning. So you know, you wouldn't expect a horse to be hyperinsulinemic from its overnight hay if you went first thing in the morning. So that's probably good timing.
And it would align with how the horse would naturally have it during the 24 hours, that you're not changing anything by actively fasting them.
Yeah, you're just giving it breakfast as normal.
Exactly,
kind of
as normal. That's what we really wanted to know.
Instead
of doing something artificial with fasting and stuff like that, because that might change things.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you want to test it in the eyes of being in the normal state, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And just see, you know, how bad does the insulin get? You really want those peaks. You know, I think in the future, it would just be amazing. I think I mentioned in one of the presentations earlier, these nice devices that I'm sure people with diabetes will be aware of, where you can constantly measure your interstitial glucose with this little device that sticks on. It would just be amazing if we could get something like that to monitor insulin.
Yeah.
And you could see where the insulin was going during the day and where it was peaking. And that would just be so good. But unfortunately, that doesn't exist yet.
Yet. we have a lot to look forward to in terms of developing new tools. And last but not least, I would like to ask you if you have any special myths or misconceptions about PPID or insulin dysregulation or both that you want to seize the moment and sort of debunk. Which would those be?
Well, I think our general knowledge of these conditions has just increased massively over the years. So there are definitely some lots of weird myths in the past that I now think we've got over. But I suppose the main one still, which we've just been discussing, is, I'm not sure if it's a myth as much as still a lack of focus and a lack of awareness of the importance of insulin dysregulation in PPID. So I think there's still a tendency to think that when we start talking about insulin, we're talking about EMS. And when we're talking about PPID, we're talking about ACTH. And that is just not true. You know, the insulin is so important. And, you know, I would certainly say that is something that we are definitely still struggling with. When I look in at the, if you like, the laboratory submissions in the UK that come into our lab, it's still remarkably uncommon to be getting insulin samples sent in from PPID cases. Yeah. So I think that myth, if you like, that insulin is related to EMS is something, yeah, worth exploding, really, and people focusing on its equal importance in PPID.
Thank you so much, Andy, for joining us today on this podcast. It's been really interesting and thought-provoking, some of your messages, but I hope that they will get across. Also, you who are listening, don't forget to watch the webinars. They are very interesting as well. Thank you so much for participating.
Oh, thanks for asking me.
Tack för att du lyssnar på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, glöm inte att trycka prenumerera i din podcast-app så att du inte missar några avsnitt. Berätta också gärna om vad du tycker genom att ge en recension. Vi tar gärna emot tips på kommande gäster och ämnen, och våra kontaktuppgifter finns i poddens beskrivning.